Yeah, going live. Just let it catch up with the stream as usual. There we go. Good evening, guys. Welcome to Live and Undrugged Series 3, Episode 7. As always, thanks to my sponsors, Mr. James Jeffries and Miss Charlie Farringdon, without whom I wouldn't be able to keep on with the Zoom. And thanks everybody for tuning in. This evening I'm with Christopher Willers from Prison to Principle, and he's going to share his life and his story and some of his experience, strength and hope. So thanks for coming on, mate. It's good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go back to the start of your journey and work from there.
All right. My name's Christopher, and a lot of people call me Life. Over here, I go by Christopher Life Willers. My story, I like telling my story because my story reflects the lives of so many people over here. I grew up. I was given up for adoption, but I didn't have a rough adoption. I was actually, my mother that raised me, Helen Harris, she had me since I was in Pampers. So I had a household with a mom. I had a household with a dad. They went through their ups and downs, but they always did their best by me. I'm not going to say that I grew up too rough. But over time, they split up. Things became or got, impacted financially. And when that happens, we went from living in a house in a cul-de-sac to moving to a townhouse and then to an apartment. And then, an apartment in maybe not a nicer part of the city of Chicago. I was a young boy growing up. At this time, my father, he was out. They didn't work out, him and my mother. And my mother had to work two jobs. So a lot of times, her working so hard, she couldn't watch me. When I wasn't at school, if I went to school, I was running around, I was exploring in the city. I was one of those people that I just wanted to know. I just wanted to know what was going on around me, why people wanted to go over here, why people went over there. I was always inquisitive. While all this was going on, while I was growing up, I was what you call, I guess, kind of the best of both worlds. But I say that not in an arrogant way, just in a way of saying that I was getting good grades in school. I was the friend that all my friends' parents loved. I did what I was supposed to do at the house. I was working an extra job, helping as I got older. But I had this whole other life when I was in the streets. I started to hustle a little bit with friends of mine. We started first just stealing video games from Blockbuster back in the day, reselling those so we could get money, going in people's cars, getting their change out so we can go to the liquor store to get somebody to buy us 40s. Then we got our hands on a little weed or whatever and sell nickel bags and dime bags, like a lot of kids, unfortunately, in Chicago do. Times progressed. In my situation, I ended up getting into trouble in high school. I was an angry teenager. Parents had split up. Mom was always gone. Again, not because she wasn't a good mom, but she had to work to keep a roof over our head, to keep food in the fridge. And she made choices, But I was angry. I used to get into a lot of fights. When that happened, eventually the high school I was going to, Glenbard East, they said enough is enough. And I was kind of done with school too. Again, I was somebody that always got good grades, but angry, just getting bored with school, not wanting to be in structure. So I ended up dropping out before they could kick me out. And part of the agreement with my mom, she was okay with it as long as I ended up going to this program. It was a shock treatment program. And basically what a shock treatment program is, it's a 6-month program that's ran by the National Guard, the Army National Guard, or some form of military, where you get your GED, they give you a stipend or some money after you graduate if you can complete it. But it's really structured, it's about discipline, and you know, it's a lot of exercise and weird punishments and stuff like that. Ironically enough, being in this situation, I excelled. I became what they call like a student team leader in there. I did good, I got my GED. I actually didn't do bad in structure. And then at 17 years old, I told my mother I wanted to enlist in the military. And she was happy because I was turning it around. You know, I might have still wanted to fight, but I was going to go fight for the military. So she's like, all right, let's do something good. And I went to the military at 17. And for the first time, I'm out here amongst the world by myself. And I'm around adults, and I start seeing life for what it actually is. And again, I was moving fast. I was young, you know, I was big headed, and I still had that anger in me. And now I was starting to feel myself like, oh, I'm all the way over here in California, or I'm here in North Dakota, I'm by myself, I'm in the military, I'm paying bills. And what that did, it ended up landing me in more trouble because I wasn't ready to be by myself at 17, even in the military. What a lot of people don't know is being in the military is basically you go to work, you do your 9-to-5, and then you just live on base. But people still drink. People still have drug addictions. People still, they go through it. People are still living life. And for me, the fighting still continued. I was still getting into a lot of fights. Angry, rebellious, and it just was what it was, you know, mismanagement of an opportunity when I look back at it. You know, I'm not going to say I would have chose the same route back then, but as a 17-year-old kid that made it out of Chicago into the United States Air Force, which is the hardest branch to get into, I should have took the opportunity. Because I got in so much trouble fighting, I got kicked out of the military and ended up not moving back to Chicago. Well, I went to Chicago briefly for a few months, but then relocated to the Commonwealth of Virginia, where my family, my mother had moved while I was in the military. The Commonwealth of Virginia, if I can explain to anybody that may be unfamiliar, it's basically for me, in a respectful way, because some people take it the wrong way, but it's like living in the country. And I'm from Chicago, and Chicago is one of the biggest cities over here in the States. So, you know, I came with my big city, quote unquote, mentality to this, quote unquote, you know, country state, but they were moving just as fast as I was. Ended up hooking up with an older cousin of mine. Again, still angry. Now I'm angry because I messed up my opportunity to be in the military. I'm back living with my mother. I'm 19 years old. And one day my cousin comes to me and he's like, hey, I need you to take a ride with me and a couple of my buddies. And I'm like, what's going on? He's like, man, we're going to go make this a couple of hours. So I asked him what was going on. And, you know, young kid trying to prove myself to the family member, you know, older friends, I agreed to go along. And what was going on was they going on a robbery. They wanted me to drive. I was the only one with a vehicle at the time. And I agreed. And, you know, in my mind, the justification was nobody was going to be hurt physically. I knew nobody was going to get hurt physically. Well, at least I thought that way. I felt like I could trust my cousin, his friends. I felt like they were just going to scare the people. That was it. So I didn't really see, but really didn't really understand the amount of trouble we could get in if we got caught. The robbery occurred. Nobody got hurt physically. But as I say, present day, now, you know, if somebody's about to be 40 years old, I understand the effects of mental and emotional trauma. You know, I do know that that happened. And I do, you know, I hold myself accountable for the part I play. But what I will say is, when you look at sentencing guidelines and all these different things when it comes to the laws over here in the States, my story reflects countless teenagers from the ages of 17 to 21 when it comes to over-sentencing, et cetera. In my case, why I say that, here I go, This is my first time ever getting in trouble. We ended up getting caught for the robbery after my cousin and his friends cooperated. Of course, I turned down the deal. Again, because I thought that was the right thing to do. And I'm sitting here in a situation where they basically, because I didn't cooperate, they didn't want to give me a deal. And they didn't care that it was the first time I got in trouble. And on top of that, like I tell younger guys that I talk to, younger men and women, hopefully you're not in the streets, but if you are, know the laws. Understand what's going on. Because in my case, I thought even if we got caught, I would have got an accessory charge. But what I found out was when I got arrested, there was no such thing as an accessory charge in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I got charged just like I went into the place and robbed the people too. And I would say as a 19-year-old kid going through that, again, I always held myself accountable, but I didn't understand what was going on. And because of that one robbery, what happened is they don't charge you for the incident. They charge you for the number of people within the incident. So now what happened was I ended up getting charged with 6 robberies, 6 use of firearms, and 6 conspiracy charges. And I was facing multiple life sentences, 6+ to be exact. As I kind of fast forward through the story, bits and pieces, I'm sitting in the courtroom the day of sentencing. I wasn't given an opportunity at a plea. I'm standing in front of the judge, standing in front of my lawyer because he came back to the bullpen and talked to me. And he said, "Hey, the best I can do is get you 35 years to do." And I said, 35 years to do just like that? I said, "There's no way." I said, "I can't do that." But he felt confident that he could actually come back there with that information and get me to agree with that, which is scary because now as a grown man looking back, I wonder how many teenagers or people that didn't know or didn't understand in the moment, competency level, et cetera, would have just said yes and probably did. So when I told him I can't do that, he said, "Well, you need to tell the judge something. I got to tell him something. We got to make him happy." Or the prosecutor. I said, "Man, just tell him I want to be home before I'm 40. And that was the hardest decision I probably made to date because I had to try to figure out an amount of time I could give up from my life to make the judge happy and an amount of time that I would be okay with sacrificing, and still coming home off of. And that was it. We went out there. I tell everybody, if you're running, you're running with a gang, you're running with a clique, you're running with a street crew, whatever. I was a pretty popular guy my whole life. I've always been somebody that, everybody got along with. I got along with everybody, the skaters, the rappers, whoever. But when I got to that courtroom, nobody was there but my mother. That's it. And she got on the stand. She spoke her piece. And before I knew it, I was sentenced to 144 years in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but they suspended all but 19. So 19 years old, sentenced to 144 years, all suspended but 19. And in terms of mathematics, you got to do 85% of that in the Commonwealth, which is basically impossible because that means you got to stay out of trouble the whole time. So that was that. That was the sentencing portion. I'm going to keep speeding it up because it's so much. I tell people all the time, my journey in prison was different. At the jail, I ended up getting tagged, getting put on a gang card because me and a couple of other young guys, we just kind of hung together. Clicked together and people in the jail kind of gave us a title, followed me to the prison. And I want to say this for anybody that's never been to prison before I go into this part. If you've never been to prison, stop thinking that you can survive in prison. Stop thinking that prison is sweet. Stop thinking that prison is like what you see on TV because whatever you're seeing on TV, it doesn't compare to what you're going to feel when you're behind those bars or that behind this barbed wire and you can't get home. I had to say that, man, because more and more, I think people really don't understand the impact of prison. At jail, the jail was all right. Nobody wants to be locked up, but at the jail, I was still surrounded by people that were around from the town that I got locked up at. So there was still familiarity there. There was still, we were still close enough, close but far. Once you go to prison, you don't know anybody. I knew nobody. I didn't have any allies. I didn't have anybody that I could click up with. It was me, originally from Chicago, locked up in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and sent to a maximum security prison, Sussex 2 State Prison. It was violent. People lost their lives on there. A buddy of mine ended up losing his life 2 days before he was supposed to go home, stabbed to death over a 5-inch TV, because of the debt he didn't pay, supposedly, or whatever. That's how the story was told. It's traumatizing. It was all of that. I worked my way from Sussex 2 to another camp, Greensville Correctional Center, where death row is, or excuse me, that's where the executions are at. And I'll never forget the address, 901 Corrections Way, because 9:01 p.m. is when they do the executions. And the day of the executions, there's an energy on the camp where everything is just really settled. It's calm. Nobody's really messing with nobody. The guards don't bother nobody. It's really solemn. And that's just something that really, it just stuck out to me as I'm thinking about the different things I've gone through. I've touched other institutions like St. Bride's Correctional Center, where they call that gangland. I've touched other institutions as well. I tell people another aspect of my story that a lot of people don't talk about is I got married while I was incarcerated. Me and my wife just celebrated our three-year anniversary, as a matter of fact. Met her while I was running a nonprofit while incarcerated, which is a whole nother, story. But met her. She's a great part of my foundation from when I came home, transitioned home. As you put the title from prison to principal. When I came home, I had got my barber's license while I was locked up. And she was already an educator in master cosmetology. She was passionate. She wanted a school. While incarcerated, I had got a reputation as I grew up behind those bars, going from a hothead to meeting a good brother by the name of Jefferson Ellie, who helped, change my life. Other brothers like Freddie William, Brother Willie. They challenged me while I was incarcerated to grow up, to hold myself accountable, to start helping people instead of leading people the wrong way, because I always had influence. So I got this reputation of helping people. I was, whether it was in a law library, whether it was a mentor in a pod, whether it was somebody, I would just help guys write letters, et cetera. So I had a passion for helping people. And me and my wife put that together. When I came home, it was a grind. I tell everybody I started on a garbage truck. Worked for the garbage on the back of a garbage truck 3 times since I've been home. Worked in warehouses, all that. But when I came home, one thing I did was I never stopped believing in myself. I leaned on my support. And me and my wife presently, we were business owners, we're school owners. That's why it's from prison to principal. And recently I was highlighted on CBS or Atlanta's News First. Where my story is about me doing 16 years, 11 months combined in prison and presently being a principal of a vocational school in Atlanta with 100% graduation rate right now. And that's like my story sped up. I like the way you gave me opportunity kind of, and I sped up, I left bits and pieces out, but I guess I wanted to just say this. If anybody's seeing any of this, any part of my story, my main reason for wanting to speak is one, to encourage you to tell your story, and two, to take away excuses. prior to me coming home, I came home January 13th of 2020. I remember very quickly the Kobe Bryant and his daughter passing and the passengers on the helicopter. And then about a month or two after that, the pandemic hit. And I'm home after 17 years in prison. I'm trying to get a job. They're laying people off. It seems like the world's coming to an end. I'm watching the news, you know, the numbers of people losing their lives to this, you know, to COVID is going up. I'm dealing with anxiety. I'm married. I got locked up when I'm 19. I come home. Technology has shifted. There was no such thing as social media there was MySpace, I think, at best. When I came home, it was Instagram and smartphones, and it was overwhelming. And anybody that's watching this, if you are coming home from incarceration, if you're battling mental illness, because that's something I talk about a lot on my platform as well, D100 TV. If you're dealing with addiction, whatever it is, you have to slow down. You have to take your time. You have to find your path. When I came home, I tried to speed up and run with everybody. And I learned quick. I had to find my own way. But nothing is impossible. It's just you discipline, consistency, and making the right decisions. You know, making the hard decisions, the abnormal ones, to make sure you can get to where you need to go. Outside of that, I kind of spoke on a little bit, launched a platform on social media called D100 TV, where we got a community here on Facebook, started going viral on TikTok, where just started doing shorts about my story and my thoughts about coming home from incarceration. And then, like I said, also on my quest for, I call it mental health instead of mental health, you know, or mental illness, being diagnosed, knowing a bunch of buddies of mine, not just formerly incarcerated, but ex-military, et cetera, and wanting, as a pretty confident guy, somebody that's not afraid necessarily to be out front and say, hey, it's all right. Like, it's okay to go to therapy, stuff like that. And then we're on YouTube too, where you can see the live stream. We sit down. We got ex-COs, got guys I was beefing with back in the day, but we're actually great friends now because it's a different circumstance, different life. But yeah, it's a lot of dialogue, it's a lot of conversation, and I'm just continuing to do my part because my story, like I said, it reflects countless others, 30 seconds of bad decisions. A lot of times it costs people lives, you know, years. So I think that's it.
Yeah. Wow. What a story. American prisons are so different to British prison. You know, I can only imagine what that's like. You know, I've only seen what, you know, like you said, I've only seen what is on TV and on the internet and, you know, what we see, what the media shows us. But I don't think that I can quite grasp what it's like to be told you're getting 144 years.
It's crazy, right? I remember before I had went to court, running around in the jail trying to talk to the guys that had been down for a minute. And, hey, how much time do you think I'm going to get? And I remember also paying attention to the other guys that had robbery charges. And I watched one guy, he was 16 years old, and he got a life sentence. And I was like, I'm in trouble. I said, I'm in trouble. I had a chance because I was the driver, but nonetheless, I didn't cooperate. And I had to throw myself basically at the mercy of the judge. I didn't know, he could have woke up on the wrong side of the bed that day and just felt like giving me an extra 10 piece, which I'm sure happens. But I knew going into the courtroom that the big, you're going to get the bigger number first, 144 years. But when I heard it, I think I was more concerned with my mother being in the courtroom, because now there's a face to this mess. This is how bad your son messed up. I'm not going to say that I wasn't scared. I've been scared plenty of times in my life, but I think it was just at that point, in some weird way, I was ready for it to be over with, because it was the weight. It was the wondering how much time I was going to end up with. That was the hard part. But when they said the initial number, it's kind of like I blinked out and I came back as he was giving me the rest of the sentence. And my lawyer had to lean over and he said, "You got 19, which means if you stay out of trouble, it's about 16 years and some change." Which I'm still not trying to hear, but at least now I know I got a chance to go home. And that might sound crazy to anybody that's never been in a situation like I've been in, but you got robberies, you're in the Commonwealth of Virginia, you're Black, whatever it is, here you go. You know, this is your reality, because people are getting sent away for long periods of time, you know, for things like this, and way longer than what I am. So a lot of people don't come home.
True. I mean, we have life sentences here. We have whole life sentences here that is for the lowest of the low. You know, the serial killers and stuff like that. Generally, a life sentence, you're looking around 25 years. You know, that they can give you a life sentence and then give a recommended sentence of like serving 10 years before you can be considered for parole, or, you know, 18 years or whatever. But then you're not guaranteed to get parole. You know, and the only thing I can sort of put my head into when you're talking about when you got 144 years, it was when I was told that I had cancer. It must be that sort of same heart-wrenching thing, you know. There are gangs in our prisons, you know, postcode gangs and stuff like that. But it's still a big thing. But it must be massive in America, everywhere you look on TV, it's gang upon gang upon gang. And I suppose that if you're gang affiliated, you get a little bit rougher than everybody else.
Yeah, it's gang culture. It's weird. It's weird because it's never really the guards that control the prisons. It's usually, you know, the big dogs or the shot caller, whatever it is within the blocks, that kind of help implement a culture, you know, in the block. And it actually, a lot of times, works better than if the guards tried to control the block. But with gangs, what happened is a lot of times guys get involved and they click up and they're not ready to uphold what they signed up for. So a lot of times you see gang on gang violence, but it's them, they're cleaning up their houses and it gets ugly. But nonetheless, accountability. You know, you got to have enough sense to know if you're not really about this life, if you're not, this is not what you want, stay away from it. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't, because there's a lot of people sign up for gangs when they locked up, they're scared, they're running from debts, whatever it is. So they're bringing their problems into that gang. And a lot of times those guys don't know until it's too late and it just causes conflict. But yeah, it's depending on where you're at in the system. You can find your own path. I know guys like a brother, Lord Unique, I don't think he ever got into one fight, and he was down double digits. He was down at least 15 plus years and never got into a physical altercation. So it's not impossible. You know, you can maneuver without getting clicked up. You don't have to get with a gang, but you got to be on point and you got to make the right decisions. But typically you want to stay out the politics. You want to stay out of having to interact with more people than you would because you're in prison. It's problems.
Yeah. So, I mean, over here with the education system, you can get an education when you're in there. You know, back in my day, I mean, you're talking like 90s. And I only know what I've been told. I've been out a long time, but I only know what I've been told by people that have come out sort of more recently than I have, that it's our prisons, it's all about governors and numbers and filling seats and, you know, ticking boxes. So the more likely to choose someone who wants to go into education, who wants to do a higher sort of education, like a degree or something along those lines, than somebody that wants to go and learn to read and write. I needed to learn to read and write. But, you know, the more likely to help you better, or they were more likely to help you better if you were doing a higher sort of degree. What's the education system like in the American prison system?
Well, I would say you have to enroll to get your GED, with your general equivalency, if you don't have a high school diploma already, a GED, which I think is good that they make you do that. Back in the day, when I first got in the system, they didn't do that. After that, as far as vocations, you can sign up for one vocational trade. Typically, sometimes guys get lucky and they can sign up for, you know, multiple. And the trades are pretty good. And I think the way it is here in the States, people are leaning more away from college education and more into vocational trades. But you can get, I've seen behind Commonwealth of Virginia prison walls, welding, pipe fitting, carpentry, brick masonry, barbering, like myself, I got my barber license, computer aided drafting, auto mechanics, pretty good trades. Everybody doesn't necessarily take advantage of it, but they're there. As far as college education, they do have college programs, but it's typically dependent on the institution. I had an opportunity to go to college. I always brag, I was getting a 4.0 GPA, but then they killed the funding for the program, so I wasn't able to complete. But I do got a buddy of mine, he just re-enrolled. He's going to college programs, I believe, on Buckingham. So yeah, or Baskerville. So they're there. Education is one of the few things I have complaints about, I think, as far as the prison system. I'm not saying it's the best, but considering that a lot of us don't have education when we get incarcerated, I think they're doing an okay job. Yeah.
Yeah. What's the support like when you get out then? Because it's not great here. You know, mostly all you need is a postcode, you know, to go to. And you can earn money when you're in there. Not a massive great deal, but you can earn money doing jobs. And obviously you have to do things like CC your probation officer and things like that. But, you know, there's no real support out there for, you know, people. I'd like to see that prison farm. I think there are a few prisons that are in the UK that are looking into, you know, some of the college programs and educational programs and personal programs that help you with therapy and stuff like that. Yeah. Just like Grendon. But mainly there's not the support there. You get sent out with a plastic bag with your stuff in. And yeah. A bit of money in your pocket. What's it like over there for that? For
Yeah, that's how it was when I first came in the system. You got a bus ticket and $25, and they didn't care where you went. Eventually, they passed the law where they take a percentage of your check, which isn't much. If you know about how much you make in prison, which is about 27 cents an hour on a good day. But they would save a portion of your money up to $1,000. So, and they would make you get your driver's license. They make you get your social security card and birth certificate if you don't have those things. At first, guys were angry about it. I wasn't, because it was, I knew I needed these things when I came home. And I think this is a good thing that they instituted, because $1,000, it's not much, but it's way more than $25 now, or $25. And then the other thing is, they now make sure you have somewhere to go. So they make sure you get a home plan approved. And if you don't have an address, they make sure you get hooked up with a halfway house. So that portion is. But it's hard, though. You know, when it comes to guys that are trying to find specific jobs, sometimes housing, because the wrong charge, if you have a drug charge, it's hard to rent an apartment. And then just employment, depending on how the climate is. You know, if there's a lot of jobs available, it's easier for felons. But if not, a lot of times felons, their applications, they get pushed to the back. It is what it is. If an employer sees somebody with no felons, more than likely that's who they're going with. But I will say, a lot of the people I know as far as like support, I think about Commonwealth of Virginia, even though I'm down in Atlanta, Georgia now, there's a lot of help organizations. There are a lot of places you can go to. There's a lot of people that just have this wealth of knowledge, like Monique Yesenia and Sisters in Prison Reform, all these different faces that are understanding what guys coming home from prison need. You have people that are fighting there, you know, not just advocates, but making sure that society knows what people need. One of the biggest things you just touched on that I think they lack on here, aside from being able to really get employment placement here, is the mental health services. In the States, they say, as far as the incarcerated population, over 70% has either diagnosed or undiagnosed mental illness. If this is true, there needs to be more help there, and there just isn't. Hopefully that changes, you know, and we'll see, but that's one of the places that it definitely lacks in over here. The other thing I think that I would like to, that I think they should implement for us is financial literacy programs. So guys understand banking and credit, because a lot of times we just don't know. We even if we know how to make money, we don't know what to do with it. And the majority of times guys get locked up, it's financial reasons, man. It's money, etc. But my situation was different. Like I said, I came home married. You know, my mother, my uncle, my cousin, you know, I had a group of friends around me. So my path was easier. You know, I had to work hard and do certain things, but I was able to get my license the first day. A lot of guys aren't able to do that, you know, and it's just, it's those obstacles that I think need to be looked at more. You know, you can't get mad at a guy that he can't get a job because he doesn't have a license yet. He can't drive, you know, so just a lot of different things. But there has to be, I feel like there needs to be more support after the fact, outside of probation, just more specific when it comes to mental health.
Yeah, I mean, as a country, we're not great on mental health. You know, the system's kind of messed up, especially it got even worse during COVID. You know, and there are people that are really struggling with their mental health and they can't get the help. You know, I know people that have been battling years to get diagnoses, and it's just not happening because the spaces just aren't there. So they're going out, committing crime, because they'll know they'll get, you know, a certain amount of help in prison. And that's a sad state of affairs, you know. Right. What's the mental health policies like in your country? Are they?
It's hard. It's a challenge to get mental health assistance. Whether you're somebody coming home from incarceration or not, it's just one of those things that, unfortunately, it's almost like you got to stay on the phone and stay on hold. You got to do that a whole bunch of times to get to where you're going. They have services over here like 211 if people are, you know, possibly feeling suicidal in a moment, where you can call to get immediate help, which they're working on. They're getting better at that, which is good. But as far as finding a therapist, as far as finding support groups and stuff like that, it does take work. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons people don't get help over here, is because it can be exhausting. And I know a couple of times I had got frustrated and was like, man, I can't keep trying to live. They keep running me around. And my wife was like, no, we're going to find a therapist. And she took over for it. She got it done. But, you know, it was phone calls. It was sitting down with the first two therapists to figure out they weren't the right ones. Not just going to therapy, just going through the motions, but getting with somebody that, you know, was challenging and, you know, stuff like that. But you do have to prepare yourself. But just know that once you find it, if anybody's watching this, once you find your help, therapy, support group, social worker, etc., then it becomes easier. You just got to break that ice though. And it should be easier, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, we have a National Health Service, you know, that's free at the point of access, you know, and it's great having that. It's absolutely wonderful that we don't pay for the majority of our healthcare. Mm. However, when it comes to mental health, and because the majority of the country is quite messed up, especially with COVID, and you know, a lot of people now are starting to understand about things like depression and you know, anxiety and, you know, the difference between mental illness and mental health and trauma and stuff like that, you know, becoming more informed. The queues are just absolutely mental. So people are still not getting seen. Yeah. And that, you know, that's an unfortunate thing of having a free health system, whereas, you know, and I know you have to pay for yours. There are, am I correct in thinking that there are some sort of benefits like Medicare and stuff like that?
Yeah, we'll do like what they call like co-pays and stuff like that, where we just basically, we pay a percentage, but insurance here in the States is tricky. Like, for instance, depending on the insurance, it might not cover what you need. So one insurance will, one insurance won't. This insurance might be $300 a month from your check. This insurance might be $150. And it's crazy how the insurance thing is set up when it comes to health. And but you do have a little bit more control, because if you say you want to get a specific type of insurance and you know they got coverage for mental health and it's going to be easier within their network, then you can choose to do that. So that's the plus side, but it gets costly. It gets tricky. And it's a challenge. Not everybody can afford insurance over here.
No. I mean, there's been talk of, you know, insurance schemes coming over here, you know, trialing, and, you know, there are people, because I've been ill before, because I have, certain illnesses and things like that, I couldn't get insurance full of no money. You know, and I presume it's like that if over there, if you've got certain life-changing illnesses, it's going to be really, really difficult to either get insurance or be able to afford.
Yeah, it's horror stories. You have, unfortunately, you have situations where people, life-changing illnesses, and they're not able to get specific help because the enrollment period, or because they can't afford that specific type of insurance, or because their insurance doesn't cover the procedure that needed to be done right then. And it's scary. You know, not everybody has the financial means, you know, and a lot of people, unfortunately, they're making decisions based on finances versus their health. But it's the way that, it's set up over here. And then you got inflation and over here and a recession and everything else going on. And yeah, it's not always that easy. It should be as easy as if somebody has a child that's sick, you know, you should be able to walk in there. They should be able to be okay and be seen and walk back out. But it's not. It's one of those things I don't think a lot of us will ever truly understand.
Tell me about the school.
Yes, school. I love talking about the school. The school has its own culture. It's Last and Layers of Beauty Institute. You can check us out at www.lastinglayersofbeautyinstitute.com. And I'm just proud of us, man. Our first year, we learned a lot. And in the midst of learning, we grew a lot, because that's when you grow, when you learn. And in the midst of us growing, we were able to have 15 graduates, which a lot of people are saying that was a record for year one. We're a cosmetology school, estheticians, nail techs. We have instructor programs, and we have state board licensure. My school, the way I run the school, we're very community oriented. We believe in getting with other, you know, brands and businesses and, you know, connecting the dot and supporting each other. So that's one thing we always, you know, took pride in. And also from the start, we take pride in just taking care of people. And we appreciate everybody that walks in there, because I remember times where me and my wife, we would sit there and we would just hoping somebody would walk in there today. You know, our first student, she enrolled in our school, Hayden, before it was even a school. We were still, the floors were still ripped up. We were doing plumbing, but she believed in us, you know. And I think that's the winning formula. We've always just, whether it was one person in the school, whether it's to the place now where we have close to 30 students, multiple graduates and programs, we always just make sure the person knows that we care about them being here. And they tell other people, and it's turned into this word of mouth thing. My wife, it was her vision, but she's old school, and she, you know, she said, hey, you lead our household, lead the business. But I really just get her back. I support her. I support the instructors, because that's what leadership is. Leadership is just servitude. It's just making sure the people around you can be successful. So I just make sure they're good, and my instructors are amazing. They make sure the students are good, and I don't know, we rock out. We're loose, where you can come in there, you can breathe, you don't have to feel all uptight, but when it's time to put in work, we put in work, and we're continuing to grow, and it's just fun. It's weird, because, you know, the story came out, I was in prison, and now I'm a principal. And I thought I was scared about people finding that out, but the students had known. They knew before I knew that they knew. They had found me on social media when we started going viral. And nobody cared, because, unfortunately, so many people over here, they know somebody that's been incarcerated, you know, or been impacted by it. So a lot of people are rallying behind it, and it's cool.
It's great. I commend you for it. You know, I commend anyone that has lived a certain life, and then, you know, despite everything that they ever knew, they've turned it round and you know, fought to become a better person, and not only fought to become a better person, but fought to help other people become better people, whether that be learning a trade or whether that be, getting them back into school, or, you know, literacy, or like you said, with numbers and stuff like that, and teaching about finances and things. I commend you for that. I commend anyone for that, who can inspire other people by talking about their lives. You know, that's just the reason that I set this up initially, so people could share the stories. I know what it's like not to have a voice. You know what it's like not to have a voice. And there's not many people that will give a platform to people like us. So I felt that I needed to create one.
Right.
You know, the next step for me is a streaming site with people like yourself, giving education, doing keynote speeches and, running classes, one or two lessons, and help that would be free to access, because I believe that education should be free.
Yeah, I'd love to be a part of that. Let me know if I can help.
Yeah, that'd be great. It's called Shedley, because, like I said before, I do all this in my garden shed. I was asked not. It used to be called ShedX, and I was asked not to use that by people at the Independent TED place here, because they kind of took offence to my sort of parody. But yeah, it's Shedley, and it's going to be like this, you know, talking to people like yourself, and people like yourself, you know, even if it's a one lesson on giving a haircut, or one lesson on how to do nails, or
definitely,
you know, it's a bank, isn't it? Access. It should be the norm, and people should have done it before. But it's left to people like us that have lived a certain way, because I believe if you can teach, teach. And if you can't teach, you should still teach.
Right.
So, yeah. Is there anything you'd like to say to people before we finish?
No, I mean, I know I was a little bit, I was jumping around just trying to give points to my story. As always, I just want to say, first of all, thank you, for having me. Thank you to everybody that, checked out the content and story. I would say to anybody watching this, if you want your situation to change, then change your situation. Yes. Like, it's nobody else can do that for you. You can be in a room full of 20 motivated people. And I'm not saying that's a great thing to do. You can read 100 books, inspirational books. Do that. That's a great thing to do. Go to therapy. Do the things that you might need to do for you. But ultimately, it all comes down to you saying, I want to change my situation. I want to change my outcome. And making the decisions day in and day out to do that. And just know that if you got anything from my story, if a guy can do close to 17 years in prison and come home and be a principal, have a successful marriage, continue to grow, I help out in my community. If I can do these things, you can too. And that's it, man. Change your situation if you want to change.
Very wise words. Thank you, my friend. Thank you, guys, for tuning in, as always. I shall see you again next week for episode 8. We have Jason Cook coming on to talk about his life and his books. But as always, thank you, guys, and I shall see you again pretty soon.